On this episode of the Film Threat Podcast, the role of Anthony Ray Bench will be played by John Schnepp. The show. I am Chris Gore, sometimes known as That Chris Gore, and this is a bonus episode, actually. We are headed to Phoenix Comic Con, where the Film Threat panel will be on Friday night, 7:30 p.m. That's this Friday, May 26th, 7:30 p.m. You can see the Film Threat podcast live with myself, John Schnepp, TJ Chambers. And I am riding in the car right now in a vehicle with my good friend John Schnepp from Collider Heroes. And driving the car actually is a comedian, actor, friend of mine, Cody Gidley. And I just want to say welcome to the show, guys. Bonus episode of Film Threat.
Yeah. What's up, Chris? Glad to be on here.
Well, what's weird is like, okay, first of all, we should have been recording actually for the last couple hours because we have delved into Marvel movies.
Extreme nerdiness, extreme conversations.
The fate of the Fantastic Four and the X-Men. It's just been like a cavalcade of conversation topics, all geeky and nerdy. And I don't know, like, I think that's also like, John, like you and I have like this, because we've known each other, I think since 94?
Yeah, 94. I met Chris Gore at the Chicago Underground Film Festival, the very first film festival, the very first year it was running. I had a film in there. It was a science fiction comedy short that I had made with a pal of mine. It's called Mad Science. Chris Gore saw it. We ended up hanging out, and then he became my friend.
Well, it's weird, because Mad Science, I describe it as like a lost short. Because that era, you used every possible... It was like... the way I described it to people, it's sort of like the 66 Batman Adam West TV series, but like with science and sort of a Sid Marty Krofft vibe, but it was incredibly over the top and bizarre. You starred in it with a friend of yours, and it's one of those, you have to put that short online or get it released somehow.
Yeah, we're actually planning on putting it out at the end of this year, so it'll be available for people to finally see after 25 years.
For people who do not know who you are, John Schnepp, you've had this amazing career from working for MTV, doing graphics as a director, working at Titmouse on Adventure Brothers, on Metalocalypse, and whenever I saw your name came up as director, your episodes of Metalocalypse were always the best episodes.
Oh, thanks, Chris. I appreciate that. You know, Metalocalypse was like a real fun project to work on. I did 8 years of my life was devoted to making Metalocalypse, not only directing the episodes and producing all of the episodes and overseeing everything, also doing all of the music videos for the concert world tour that Brendan went on. I'd say about 80% of all the music videos I directed and edited, and it was a lot of fun. The world of metal was so much fun to be a part of.
But like, I remember, there was an episode that you directed that made my kids cry.
It was Deaf Kids when the little, you killed me, when the little girl died at the end.
The little girl died at the end, and I remember that just, like, was incredibly upsetting to my first of all, how irresponsible am I as a father to let my kids watch this little cartoon show?
But awesome, Chris. You taught your kids about death, and just that end sequence was so amazing because it was, like, came out of nowhere. I worked on that sound design of, like, the, you killed me.
No, it was, like, I'm dead because of you.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's like her voice backwards at different tones. It's like, it was a lot of work, and I loved like people walking by the office like, what the fuck are you working on? It's like, oh. They're like giving people nightmares even before it came out.
But it's weird because the show, I just know that you definitely have a creative stamp where it's you could do this the traditional way, but there'll always be something that kind of comes out of left field what the fuck? Like, why did you do that? Whether it's use of sound or imagery, especially in Metalocalypse when they would go to, like, music video, when it would be a music video kind of within the show, there's just visual imagery that just was bizarre. And I think that was one of the cool things about the show. Obviously, you're not limited, you know, budget-wise. It's not like you have a crowd, but there's, like, you can think of anything. Some of the ridiculous crazy stuff that happened in the show. I mean, if you can draw it, it's you could if you can think it, you can draw it, you can send the show.
Yeah, you know, I remember my I think it was the second episode of Metalocalypse. Like, I had been working on Space Ghost, and I'd done a couple of Aqua Teen, so I was like in the Adult Swim landscape and having that had that freedom to just do weird stuff. I remember there was a death sequence where this character who ended up coming back. He died in the episode, but then I kind of brought him back at the very end by doing a graphic saying he didn't die, he just got robot eyes. So then I also inserted him into like an episode, I think it was the death comedy episode. He's in the courtroom kind of laughing. And so we actually ended up bringing him actually back from the dead, and he became their record producer. But his name was Nubler, and I came up with this whole sequence where it's like, instead of him just dying and his eyes exploding, let's make it like a minute and a half slow push of him screaming. And I remember it was like, even Brendan and Tommy were like, oh, it's too long. And it was like, that it was that long was what made it funny for me. So I think we cut out like 30 seconds. So now it's like, I think it's 1 minute of him just, like a real slow push towards him, then his eyes explode. So that kind of having that freedom to be able to try really weird forms of humor was like what is so exciting about really doing anything in the adult world of animation, Metalocalypse.
Well, I have a very specific weird question related to Metalocalypse.
Sure.
That I have to ask. Okay, so whenever you would introduce these sort of new characters, there'd be like a dossier about them, or there'd be some sort of new person they would bring in. It's not like, I'm trying to think of the way to phrase this, the best way to phrase it. The people were just weird looking. I guess the best way to describe it is they look like a yearbook from the 50s and like a teacher from the 50s in terms of what they look like physically. Like, they don't make humans like that anymore. Like what I mean is that you look at these people and it's like, where was the reference to draw the people's faces who looked so unusual? And the only thing I could think is this is like from a bygone era or something. It's like you used photo reference of people out of like I don't know, like, where did you draw people that look so freaking weird? And I'm not saying that they're gross. I'm saying just weird looking people.
Well, those kudos go to a good friend of mine, Sungu Kwan, who is the character designer. Like, I designed the actual band Death Clock and a few of the other characters, like Ravenswood and a couple of other characters. But once we got into production, I brought him in, A, because he could draw way better than me, and it was like, I really wanted the series to have this look that was not like the rest of Adult Swim. I wanted it to have, what I used to tell Brendan and Tommy is like, hey, remember those old Flash Gordon cartoons or Tarzan that were like rotoscoped and kind of all the characters had realistic anatomy? That's what I wanted the show to look like. So they, you know, they were totally cool with that and were like, yeah, let's do it that way. And so I made sure to bring in someone who can actually draw those kinds of really great characters that looked realistic but also disturbing as fuck. And like, Goo had this ability to go online and look at different faces, and you know, that's the greatest thing about being able to make this series and have instant access to like a billion weird looking normal people. And he would just like draw like 7 or 8 just kind of strange looking people, and then Brendan and Tommy would usually be like, that one or this one. I, you know, to me it was like, it was a grab bag of awesomeness. Like, when it was like, gentlemen, this week some Scribby Scrab is going to be explaining the exposition scene that we are describing to you now. There's like the Tribunal shit was always like exposition alley is what I call it. It was like, we only have 11 minutes, let's re-explain the fucking plot again. You know, so we would try to have fun, even though we were like kind of using that 1 minute to like retell the plot but advance one other storyline. Because when you have 11 minutes, you don't really have an act one, act two, act three. You have your intro, and then you're kind of like racing to the end, which was usually a concert involving death. So it's like some kind of cool fucking music video freak out concert sequence. So it was kind of like, that was the fun part. We're like, let's set up this, you know, hippie Bojangles or whatever character it was, you know. It's like, so the weirder they looked, the more satisfying.
Okay, so I was correct in my assumption that basically you really went after weird looking people.
Yeah.
Okay, good. That wasn't like someone, I'm thinking like, why was there such, because you could have just drawn generic people.
Yeah.
But they were not that way at all. They were always just strange. So that's cool. So the photo reference was actually like real. So someone on that show, it's like, that was them.
Well, I mean, Goo is so talented. I mean, he would like hybridize, like he would be like, well, he looked at least 4 different weird looking people and then come up with a unique brand new weird looking person. And we were all lucky enough.
Whoa, wait, watch it, Cody.
We're all lucky enough to be on the, be drawn into the show. Like, I'm in the show three times because I was selfish, and as a director, I was like, I want to die again. So, you know, it's like, I know Brennan and Tommy were always like, we don't want the crew to be drawn in, so we would like secretly draw other crew members in. They would never notice it because especially Brennan never knew anybody who worked on the show. He would just like come in, like he didn't know anybody, any of the main people's names who actually animated on the show. So if they showed up in the show, he wouldn't notice it. So it was kind of fun, like to squeeze people. Like, you know, here's the character designer, or here's, you know, here are the 10 Flash animators all dying on this Ferris wheel. Or, so there's all these kinds of like cool ways to, you know, like give people little fun cameo deaths. And there was never a big issue about it.
I swear you worked me into an episode. There's a guy that was like, it was like a TV host or something who had weird hair.
I think it was like, it could have been like a hybrid version of you and one of the producers whose name was Keith Fay. He used to do the Death Clock Minute. Uh-huh. And it looked like Keith Fay. It was designed like him. And then Brennan and Tommy wanted to kill him, but we were like, you know what? Let's just burn him really horribly. So he, when he comes back in the next season, he was just completely scarred, like a melted face.
Favorite line from a Metalocalypse episode, which I own all the DVDs, is the one where Nathan Explosion has the girlfriend, the really overbearing girlfriend, and they tell him, like, you got to break up with her. And he says, but what if she won't let me?
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, no, there's some amazing, amazing lines in that series. Very quotable, very quotable.
Yeah. I mean, that really was like a magical moment with that, like, because you've made so many indie movies, like, I'm trying to give people a sense of your career, but I think in a way it's just like, the stuff that I've done is kind of all over the map. I've like done some TV, but I've written books. I've worked behind the scenes on TV, and I've written some things and done some movies. And you know what? And you're like, you've done so many diverse things in your career that, like, I don't think, you know, which is, I think the reason I like to do it is I hate to get bored. I get bored pretty easily. So I could not do just one job. I like to kind of bop around and do different things. But like, yeah, you've definitely, I mean, done, I mean, like, your shorts, there's so many great shorts that you've done that, God, what are some of the ones that Film Threat put out? Yeah, you should talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I put out in 2003, I put out a weird superhero short, and then I also put out this film called The Removers, which is like a sci-fi telepathic action adventure, which also involved like a duplicate Earth showing up, and like it was very super weird, and Chris embraced it and was like, said it's the weirdest short film ever made. And I was like, hey man, thanks for that quote, can you put it out on your new DVD line that he was putting out?
Well, but the cool thing about that, this is what I've loved about your work, is it's that it's not limited with like what's traditional. It's like these bizarre, crazy ideas that are just seem to be one-upping each other, and they're just insane, and it just comes from just not thinking the same as every other human.
Well, you know what's interesting is, like, this year particularly, I wrote for Dark Horse, I wrote the Slayer three-issue comic book series, which has no humor and no supernatural anything. It's just straight up horror story about the human condition and hatred. So it was like, it was really tough to write, but I feel I'm very proud of the series, and it's issue one and two have sold out across the country and globally. So I'm very happy with that. Issue three comes out, I think, the first week of June, and I think the artist, Guau Villanova, just killed it. I was like, when I originally wanted the artist, I was like, as long as they're like a combination of Steve Dillo and Eduardo Risso and Cassidy and a couple of these other artists who also draw on a very realistic, because I wanted the art to feel very grounded and realistic and dark, and, you know, there's a lot of very adult themes and murder and horrible stuff in there, so I wanted it to be come across as real.
This is what I love about this, how we connect, and when we get together, it's almost like we have been doing a podcast our entire lives. but every conversation, whether it's like just you and I in person at a party talking about stuff, or it's like I'm running into you, or we do an episode of Collider Heroes on YouTube together, or you'll invite me to be on your show, it's almost like the conversation's continuing, because like a lot of people, they're like influenced by movies, right? And then there's, you know, there's people that are influenced by me. I feel like our influences are similar in the sense that they kind of, they're definitely a pastiche of things. Like, comic books is huge, like, huge influence. And when I saw that you like got to meet up with Bill Sienkiewicz, like, oh my God. I mean, he did like the New Mutants artwork that he did, the first, like, was it like the first 40 issues? He did the covers and all the art for the New Mutants.
Well, he came in a little bit later, like the New Mutants were already established, and I think he came in like
kind of took it over.
Yeah, I think 17 or 18, I can't remember what issue. But yeah, he took it over, and then his artwork was already kind of like, he was establishing himself when he was doing Moon Knight. He definitely came across as like having heavy influences from Neil Adams and a couple other artists, but New Mutants is where he kind of broke that mold and started experimenting and doing just crazy interesting page layouts, fully painted covers. He literally changed the game for comic book artists.
And now they're doing a New Mutants movie over at Fox. Like, I think we were talking about at lunch that there are 3 X-Men movies coming out next year. It's
the most X-Men we'll ever have. X-Men-y. Like, it's like, you know, we always joke about this. Chris and I are a little bit older, and we're like, when we were kids, it was like, and when I say kids, like in our 20s, there were no superhero movies. It was like one every 3 or 4 years, and you had to pray that it didn't suck. You know, because it was like, I've got to wait another 3 years for some other fucking bullshit. What is this Punisher shit with Dolph Lundgren? Oh, you know, it's like some like low budget. People, no one even thought any comic book movie property was worth it, really. Except for Batman and Superman. So it's kind of those kinds of things we had to wait many years for. Now we're like 30 movies a year and like 400 television series. It's like, it's too much. There's no way to even keep up with all the amazing shows that are on. So that's why it's like, it's really fun to see that, you know, the X-Men are going to not only have a New Mutants that's based off of Claremont and Bill Sienkiewicz's run on the New Mutants, but we're going to have Deadpool 2, and we're going to get X-Men Dark Phoenix with what I thought were the best parts of Dark Phoenix, or the best parts of X-Men Apocalypse, which were the brand new younger X-Men,
right?
Like Sophie Turner, the brand new Scott Summers, the brand new, all those moments in that movie was what I wish the entire movie was.
Yeah, but I do think it's important to have like to not just like, movies are great, and there's all sorts of other art that you can, that can kind of influence your creative mindset. And comics has been like, for both you and I, a huge, huge influence. I mean, I just remember reading the comics I read as a kid. When I say a kid, I mean like single digit age, like 7, 8 years old, when I would go to the comic book store. I had a newspaper out just so I could afford to buy comics. And then later, it was so I could afford to get a VCR and buy movies on VHS. Yeah, but
video home system.
but like those comic series, like I just thought as a kid I would never see, like there will never be a movie that's as good as this comic that I just read, and it's amazing to see how special effects have evolved from that period. So
yeah, I mean, we just saw like almost one of the greatest comic book scenes ever was that Civil War airport,
right,
scene, which literally felt like I was watching a living comic book ripped out of the splash pages. It was so much fun to see all those different characters, although it's movie versions of them, you know, the comic book characters that we grew up with as kids, like jumping around on a giant screen and really well done. So, I mean, that's kind of the fun part about all these kinds of films. A lot of people are like, oh, there's no more independent movies because everything are event films and this and that. Well, it's like, you know, a lot of our influences also come from like incredible 70s and 80s movies, which weren't event films, which were straight up regular movies. I could say, you know, Once Upon a Time in the West, or I could say, you know, Taxi Driver. I could say any of these kinds of films that, you know, that are done by the modern masters. I love David Cronenberg's, all of his early works. You know, it's like a lot of those films are like still influential to me and like come across through my own work.
So I mean, like, you're in your career, animation director, writer, comic book writer, you're also director. Let's talk a little bit about, just for the Film Thread audience that might not know, and there's 2 reasons I want to talk about it. I want to talk about your documentary, The Death of Superman Lives, What Happened, which, if you've not seen it, is one of the greatest documentaries about the behind the scenes of the unmaking of a movie I've ever seen. I mean, you went to great lengths. You got an interview with Tim Burton. You got an interview with John Peters, the producer, and some of the coolest stuff, the footage that you uncovered. I thought one of the coolest scenes was where you're seeing Nicolas Cage work out. Cody, you gotta, like, your following distance on some of these cars has got me a little scared. So, anyways, sorry, divert. Cody watch the driving. Anyways, so, but like this footage of Nicolas Cage as Clark Kent, and he's kind of he's workshopping the character, and he's wearing like a Mickey Mouse t-shirt and like a blazer and laughing to himself because he might have heard a joke that a comedian told a mile away. You know what I mean? Like, it's this weird, like, what would it be like to be Superman? It's not this sort of weird dark vision that Zack Snyder has conjured up. It's this, like, he's a nerd. He's a nerd who happens to have these fantastical superpowers. And that movie, you know, the footage that has leaked, I think a lot of people criticized, but you really laid out. And there's two things I want to talk about with this movie. One, I want to talk about the making of that movie, and I'm going to hand our recording device over to you to do this. But also, I want to talk to you about the way, and this will be interesting to Film Threat listeners, how you released the film, because you had people that wanted, big distributors that came in that wanted to put the film out, but you self-distributed. So first off, let's talk about the making of the film, and then I want to talk about how the film was released.
Right on, Chris. Well, the making of the film started out with just a rough idea. It was something that interested me, the artwork that was slowly released online from Tim Burton's film that never got made. And of course, other versions of Superman ended up getting made. The Bryan Singer Superman Returns, and then right. The, you know, Man of Steel, Zack Snyder's Man of Steel. So those films to me were, you know, they were different versions of Superman. I definitely liked the Man of Steel version because it was different. Right. But I always kind of wanted to see what that version of Tim Burton's was. And I collected all this artwork online, and I remember talking with some friends, and they said, oh, it sounds really interesting. Maybe you should make a documentary and do it on Kickstarter, because I had done a Kickstarter previously that year for an animated short film. And so I just was like, you know what, maybe, I just finishing up doing Metalocalypse, and then I did this, Grim Fairy Tales cartoon. And I kind of wanted to expand into some other areas of that I hadn't worked in. So doing a documentary was something that was kind of exciting to me. Like you said, we both kind of like to do different things, so I wanted to try that. And so I ran a Kickstarter to make a movie about this unmade Superman film. And they kind of like kicked off really big, and people invested their time and money into helping me make this documentary. Little did I know, I thought I could do it in 8 months. It took 2.5 years. Me and my fiance Holly Payne ended up working on it together. She's producer on it. It was a really fun film to make with your partner. It was like, because there were a lot of trials and tribulations. We went broke like 4 times. We had to sell a ton of our stuff because we didn't raise enough money. We didn't know how long it would take to get these interviews. Like, we ended up interviewing Kevin Smith and Tim Burton like 1.5 years into making the actual thing. And we didn't get John Peters until 3 months before the premiere of our movie. We had to re-edit our entire movie because he originally had said no, and then he said yes. So it was definitely one of the most interesting projects I've ever worked on in my entire life, and most challenging projects I've ever worked on, because there was nobody had my back. There was, I mean, aside from the people who invested in the film, and we did have a couple of independent people come in and give us some money, and then they get paid back for that. So
here's what I've always admired about you and your career, and this no one, and you know, it's sort of philosophy that I've taken on myself, is that, you know, and it's something Mark Duplass said actually at South by Southwest. He did the keynote 1 year, and it's always sticks in my mind, is there is no cavalry. No one's going to come and save you. You have to assume that no one's going to help. So no one hired me to write any of the books I've written. I just decided to do them. No one hired me to make a movie. I just made a movie. No one hired me. I mean, not to say that I don't get hired. I actually do get hired for jobs. But the passion projects that I'll take on myself, and I just decide to do it, and nothing's gonna stop me. And you have this similar mindset, this sort of like, it's sort of a blind positivity that can get you in trouble, you know, sometimes, but you end up actually accomplishing something, you know. And what you did with this movie, I mean, like, because I actually saw it, I mean, I own the Blu-ray, but I did see it at one of the big premiere screenings. It played at the Egyptian. The reaction was amazing. I mean, what's it like to, like, be there and see that unspool in front of you, in front of an audience like that?
Oh, it was fantastic. I mean, especially after, like, like I said, the 2.5 years of work that myself and Holly Payne and Marie Hamora, the co-editor with me, Chris Grable, who did all the bulk of the compositing, Rob Pierce, who came in and helped us finish the film. It was incredibly gratifying to see most of our friends came to this screening because we know, you know, hundreds of people, and so many people came out. And I get it. A lot of people were like, I don't know if this movie's even going to be good, but I'm going to come out and support our friends. So we are super, super happy with the critical response. We got very good reviews. We toured the world. We went to Australia. We went to London. We went to Canada. We didn't make it everywhere around the world, but we went to quite a few places and screened the film. So it was an incredible amount of, it was very satisfying to make a film and make it exactly the way that we wanted to.
And you got a lot of mainstream press. I mean, you really did get a lot of good mainstream press in major magazines. I mean, that must have helped out a lot.
Yeah, I mean, the press, people really kind of responded really good to the film, and we're very happy with wherever we went to show the film. All the press junkets and the people who were involved in putting out the press to let people know about it were very responsive to it.
Now, in spite of critics or mainstream magazines or whatever, they don't really matter. They don't. To me, the real people that matter are the nerds that are the Superman fans. And what did they think of the movie? What did the DC nerds or people like that think of the film?
They loved it, and that's one of the greatest things. When I go to comic conventions, like I said, we're going to Phoenix Comic Con, and a lot of people come up to the booth. Either they've bought the movie and they're like, this is one of the greatest things I've ever seen, thank you for making it. Or like, I never thought I'd even want to see Superman Lives. Now I wish they made that film. So I always know when someone hasn't seen our film is when they say, oh, this movie would have sucked. I'm like, you haven't seen our movie. Because when you see the film, you see from what perspective they were coming at to make this different kind of Superman. So anyone who loves the idea of Superman or superheroes in general would appreciate this aspect to it, because we've had so many different versions.
Wow. Okay. Now, as you know, there's sort of these weird truths about being an indie filmmaker that I think are really important to keep in mind, and that is that a lot of times when you're making an indie movie, the expectation that you'll ever make any money, you might just want to put that aside completely. I don't know that people, if you go into making an independent film thinking you're going to make money, I think that you're naive. And at the same time, I don't think that filmmakers should be ripped off. I think that filmmakers need to go in it like, look, I want to maximize. I want people to see it. But, you know, you've actually shockingly been able to actually make an indie movie that ended up being profitable. So can you talk a little bit about, for the independent filmmakers that I know are listening to this podcast, if you could get into all the soup to nuts, like distribution aspect, like what you decided. I mean, look, if you're willing to reveal some real numbers, maybe not like dollar numbers, but just talk about sales. Like there's, you created a playbook to release an independent film that I'm surprised people have not jumped upon and said, I'm going to do what Schnepp did, not make the same kind of movie you did, but, you know, follow the playbook of how you did your own distribution. So can you walk us through that and be as specific as possible? Don't worry about being boring, because look, we'll get back to the nerdy conversation about Star Wars and Marvel and all that stuff and comic stuff later. I really wanted to get into the granular aspects of Soup to Nuts distribution. What led you to deciding to self-distribute? And then secondly, what your plan was to self-distribute? Because I remember being with you at San Diego Comic-Con when it had just got released, and you were getting all these notifications popping up on your phone every time someone bought it. But like, start, what led to wanting to self-distribute?
All right, well, what led to wanting to self-distribute was two things. Number one, because I personally owed people money, I wanted to make sure that I could pay those people back. And so it really came down to just like a code of ethics and morals for me. Like,
but John, why did you do that? Why didn't you just act like a studio and not pay people?
Exactly. So that was the key number one thing to me, was like, all right, well, how am I going to make sure that all the money that I've spent, not just the money that people who bought into the Kickstarter, like, so that I could get them their Blu-rays and DVDs and ship those out to them. Not just making sure that that was there, but, like, the additional money, the finishing funds. I mean, when you go into any of these kinds of things where you're making a venture that you're working with other people and it's taking time, there's invisible costs that happen to you every day. It's lunches that you buy for the crew. It's just the cost of living. All these things add up. And even if you have another job, there's these costs that just slowly add up. And for 2.5 years, we spent, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars making this movie. So literally, I wanted to make sure, like, well, when we release it, how can we get that money back to pay some of these other people back? So that was my key number one thing. And so then I went to a lot of different companies. There are a vast amount, like several hundred.
What were some of the offers?
I'm not going to say what companies they were, but like some of the offers were like, hey, we'll give you $75,000 up front for finishing funds, and then you'll get 75% of all the money that comes back from all, you know, you'll, because originally sometimes you'd do a 50-50 deal with a company, or maybe it's even less than that, but they were like, well, you've all pre-marketed this, there's a big thing. So a lot of the companies I was talking to already saw that this, when it was finally released, would have some kind of return for them. But the more I looked into the aspect of getting paid back from large companies, I mean, you can go online and find out, like, oh, Harry Potter made, you know, $80 million, and nobody ever got any of their payments that they were supposed to get. Or there's certain, you know, things that are online that you can see, like, well, there's like the, you know, the fees that are, you know, payback, and like, oh, we put money into advertising and this and that, where, you know, it's so hard to, you don't want to have to audit a company to see, you know, what did you money did you make, and, you know, certain things that I noticed was like, well, it cost me, you know, $100 to do this one thing, yet this one studio says it costs $18,000. So the more you see how, like, a larger corporation has so much more money they have to spend to do specific things, I started to realize, like, what if I just distributed it myself? So what I did is I distributed it myself on my own website, which you can
What's
go to. it's www.tdoslwh.com. It's basically The Death of Superman Lives, What Happened, just the first letters, tdoslwh.com. You can go there. You can buy a digital download. And that digital download comes to you because I went into business with this company that does the company is VHX. So you can distribute your own movie digitally through VHX, and they'll do the processing of the credit cards, they'll do everything, they'll send it to the person. So all you have to do is make your website and make a deal with them. They take a very small fraction of the percentage of a sale, which is incredible. It's almost the reverse of what the other companies would do. So you're making like almost 90% of the actual money that comes in from the digital sales. And so I just started doing that. And then I ended up using another company, a Shopify, to sell my Blu-rays. So that's also part of the website. So there's all this kind of thing that you can just use that helps you make your own film available to anyone around the world. And so we've been shipping these Blu-rays to anyone around the world. We sell like one or two a week, sometimes four a week, and then we ship every 2 weeks. So that's what we've been doing for like the last, you know, since we put it out in 2015.
So mathematically speaking, these offers that were coming in, like you mentioned, $70,000. So you exceeded that. You sold more than that. I don't know, like, in terms of like units, or if you go, because I know that you did a Blu-ray run, and then didn't you like run out or have to do another run? Like, can you talk a little bit about that? And then, you know, I just want, for the filmmakers in the audience, I just want them to know, like, that there are options. And this is not a commercial for VHX.com or any of that stuff. This is like, here's a way to do it. There's other advantages for going with big companies. I mean, they do have, like, you know, big promotion arms. You were kind of a one-man show promotion arm, which, and in addition to selling your movie at Comic-Cons, and, you know, I do go to a lot of Comic-Cons. I go to Comic-Cons more frequently than I go to film festivals, frankly, because I get invited to Comic-Cons, and they treat me really well there. But I almost feel, in some sense, when I see indie filmmakers like at Comic Cons with a booth, and they've got like a poster for their movie, and they're selling DVDs and Blu-rays and whatnot. I feel in a way Comic Cons, and then you get to do a panel, and then you can do a screening of your movie, and then you can interface directly with fans, and then you can like hang. You know, like I almost think that Comic Cons in a way have kind of become. I don't want to say they've replaced film festivals, but they've become another way that indie filmmakers can reach out to an audience based on the type of movie. Can you talk about the differences? Because your movie played both film festivals and Comic Cons, kind of the differences, the advantages or disadvantages of one versus the other.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, especially specifically for The Death of Superman Lives, what happened going the Comic Con route, we released our film day and date on the first day of San Diego Comic Con, and we had a booth there. And that was incredibly advantageous. We sold hundreds and hundreds of Blu-rays at San Diego Comic Con, as well as selling hundreds and hundreds of Blu-rays online, as well as selling hundreds and hundreds of digital downloads all in that first day, because we pre-ordered and pre-sold the hype online and on just on all social media that that's the day and date release where you can get a digital download or you can be there in person at San Diego Comic Con. So I feel like by making a destination point and having Comic Cons be that destination point, especially if you're making stuff in the realm of science fiction, fantasy, superhero, action adventure, any of those kinds of realms that fit into the world of comic books, then that's the place to go to.
Well, what's interesting about Comic Cons is, for a filmmaker, is it adds another layer, another avenue. For example, at a film festival, you can appear on a panel, you can also do a Q&A post screening of your movie. And so you get the audience. There's networking to be done, which is great, but there's no commerce aspect. And I think that that's the sort of direct to consumer commerce aspect, when appropriate, is something that Comic Cons afford the opportunity, like to be able to reach out to your audience directly. When I say reach out, I mean reach for their credit cards or their cash to buy. We're giving them a good movie. Right. It's a fair exchange. Now, has this changed the way that you're approaching future projects? I know that, like, we all have day jobs. My day job is I work at Gemmer.com, G-E-M-R.com, which is a website for collectors, and you can follow me there. It's like Facebook meets eBay, and you can follow me there. I'm that Chris Gore on Gemmer. You have a day job at Collider Heroes. We all have our passion projects too. Has this changed the way you that you've like thought about how you'll approach future projects?
Most definitely. I mean, one of the cool things about doing The Death of Superman Lives, what happened is Holly Payne and myself were able to sell a TV series version of that, where we're going in depth with other films that never got made, but we're doing it in a shorter form. We're doing it as a television series where we get to concentrate on different films that we personally think would have been really fun, cool films that we wish we would have seen get made. So that's one of the, it's kind of turned into a day job for myself, but then that's kind of opened up other avenues where I'm exploring. Like, I've got a Kickstarter right now, which I look at as a pre-order to my book, which is a book that I've been working on and off for 25 years. I used to perform a lot of spoken word, crazy performance art style poetry. I started writing this book when I lived in Chicago over 25 years ago, and I just kept working on it over the years. And then even when I moved here, I wrote a couple of chapters every year, and I finally finished it. And I was like, you know what? This is what's the best way to distribute a book that's very strange, very weird? And I was like, well, I've got a lot of fans who like all the different things that I've made, just not just The Death of Superman Lives or The Slayer comic or Metalocalypse or Aqua Teen or Space Ghost, any of these different worlds that I've lived in when as a director or a writer or an editor. So this is a totally different aspect of me that probably no one has seen, especially since I stopped performing once I moved to LA. It was something that I just wanted to do. And I was like, well, you know, using a platform like a crowdfunding source as a way to pre-order the book is what I'm doing now, so that when I finally get it funded, then at San Diego Comic-Con is where people can actually go to pick up their copies live and in person, and or the New York Comic-Con. So I'm kind of looking at like the crowdfunding source way to promote yourself and make things that might not be that easy to promote any other way.
Well, I mean, you know, look, Film Threat would not be here if not for crowdfunding. I think that I think that crowdfunding is, I mean, that's the way I look at it, is I'm pre-ordering a book. I'm pre-ordering, you know, a DVD. I'm pre-ordering, I mean, I contribute to Kickstarters all the time, you know, so I was really happy to see that, that Film Threat saw success via a Kickstarter. So that was, I mean, we wouldn't be having this conversation on a podcast. But what is the Kickstarter, just so people know?
Oh, sure. And I was going to say, I got my Film Threat t-shirt like last month. Oh, I was very happy about that.
Oh, yeah.
I was very happy to contribute. Yeah, the Kickstarter, it's, if you just go to, you could like just go to Kickstarter and type in John Schnepp and it'll pop up. A JONSCHNEPP. It's called Isolated Mutations of the Assembly Line Baby.
I'm buying one.
And that is the title I've had. I've had that title for 25 years. I've got a lot of weird projects I've worked on. I just put them away, and then I've got a couple of things I'm still working on right now. But this is one of those things that I was like, I'm ready to release this onto the world. What better way than to do it via Kickstarter and have people who like my stuff already get a very early version. I'm only printing 1,000 of this special version that is going to have artwork in it that is different from the hardcover version that's coming out later in the year. So I don't know. It was just my way of like making this final version of this book something special for myself. So I was like, well, why not share it and also get a way to pre-order it so people who care about this kind of stuff will get a way to get to it. So I think if anybody who's listening to this has even like something similar, like they want to do a book or they're making a film, it's like, it's making films nowadays, especially nowadays in the world that we live in, is becoming more and more of a personal thing. It's a personal story. Even if you're storytelling, it's like, I mean, you don't have $100 million to spend, and it's a lot harder to get that, those kinds of big budgets. I'd say almost impossible. So as we look at the different ways that people are watching television, they're watching stories come to life. If you have a story that you want to tell, not just a movie, but a short or a series of shorts where you want to make your own series, that's completely possible, not just with YouTube, but you can do that with Vimeo. You can do it with all these different ways of putting your work on a platform so that people could see it. So that's the world we live in now. Why not enjoy it?
Well, I agree wholeheartedly with this. So, all right, let's, I don't know. I hope that helps some indie filmmakers think that there's like, cause I know what it's like to sort of work in that bubble where your options are, you've played at a film festival and the movie is played, but that big distribution deal is something that you didn't snag. I heard some weird statistic that like 80% of the movies, after 3 years, 80% of the movies that played Sundance still don't have distribution. So there's a lot of movies out there that are, they call them orphans, and that don't have a path to come out. And I think I think self-distribution is, I don't think it has to be a last resort. It's something that, you know, in your case, you were fortunate enough to, you know, have that as an option that you chose, not a backup plan because you didn't get an offer for a distribution deal. So that's pretty cool. All right, let's talk about nerd stuff.
And let's going back to the nerd world.
Well, this is stuff that like, I'm really, it's weird with Film Threat because Film Threat is sort of like, it's when I look back at like either the print magazine or the website, it is sort of an explosion of the stuff out of my brain that interests me. And I love groundbreaking, weird, cool indie movies. I also happen to love weird, cool nerd stuff, and just the world we live in now where all the nerd stuff that I never thought would come out like actually exists. I mean, Doctor Strange, we were talking about Doctor Strange before we started the podcast, because Cody actually, which can now be announced,
right.
Cody Gidley, our trusty sort of I know it's like you're still learning to drive, Cody. But
I'm your baby driver.
You're the baby driver. Cody was in Doctor Strange. You were Benedict Cumberbatch's body double, and in a couple of insert shots.
So,
yeah, it was really cool. It happened super random. I got picked to like double for Benedict Cumberbatch for the additional photography. And then at the very end of the spiel, they go, oh, and by the way, we might have you double for him too. And so I worked maybe 6 or 8 days or something like that. All these night shoots in a studio. And I ended up getting to double for him and doing an insert shot. Benedict was so busy, they had him do an ADR. and night shoots and stint, you know, and they were just putting them all over town. So I was very lucky, and I got to do an insert and deal with the Agamotto, and it was super cool. And oh, and the best thing about that was, you know, to see Doctor Strange from that angle and then watch the movie, and you get it, and it's about a person, and it's always about somebody or something and what you're going through and how you can make yourself better. And, you know, you don't have to rely on people. You have to get the job done.
I was going to add, I thought that the movie is one of my favorite Marvel cinematic adaptations, not only just because I love the character of Doctor Strange. I think Benedict Cumberbatch was born to play that character. Derek did an incredible job directing it. I can't wait for them to make a sequel. But they were able to make him different than Tony Stark.
Yeah.
So I think there's, like, the world of those characters, especially when they come off the page and onto the screen, it's so important to give those kind of that time that is necessary.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, the thing that I loved so much about Doctor Strange was the imagery. It was like those sort of like weird cosmic Jack Kirby, I mean, Ditko, like vomited onto the screen in the best of ways, a sort of vomit, creative vomit of ideas out of their brains. Like, it was just, those sequences were, I mean, it's one of the movies that like actually benefits from 3D. I think, you know, so many 3D movies today, it's just a cash grab. But I think that there are that small number of 3D films that come out every year that are actually worth seeing in 3D. I'm curious as to why an independent film hasn't been done in 3D. Like, just, I mean, obviously there's cost involved, but there's got, like, I wonder why indie filmmakers have not thought of, we should make this indie movie about a road trip and we'll do it in 3D. That's never gonna happen.
It should happen.
Probably because of cost.
But it should happen. They have phones now that have like 3D lenses on them. Someone should do it. Hey, whoever's going to direct the next Tangerine, make it in 3D, because that would be awesome.
Well, I'm actually obsessed with that. Like, I'm obsessed with the idea of making a movie fully on your phone. That's something I want to do, where I want to make a feature, but I'm only using my phone to do it, my iPhone 7. But like, using it in a way that like, everything I do, it's done on the phone, whether it's the editing, I'll probably do the sound in, to be honest, probably use Pro Tools. But in terms of shooting and whatnot, like, I feel like you can, there's a lot of like special effects and photographic tools that you can use on the iPhone. There's, you know, that one, was it Action FX? There's a bunch of others that are like that. Do you have any, like, I did a panel actually with Holly at, I think it was at that Florida festival or Florida con, where we talked about like filmmaking on your phone. Do you have apps that you would recommend people use?
Well, you know, there's a couple of different motion stabilizers and a little handheld, like almost like gyro camera, handheld. One is called the Pomo, I believe. It's like, I'm probably killing that. It's not called the Pomo. It's called something completely different. I can't remember. It's a really weird world. It's a weird word. Look it up. But yeah, you know what? I mean, we were talking about this earlier. It's like, I mean, my mind goes back to Jim Jarmusch, and like, you know, a lot of people, like, his earlier films were like a lot of master shots, or like one shot, like for like 7 or 8 minutes. And it's like, well, you know, it's like you live within the constraints of the budget that you live in, and then you try to tell the story around that, as opposed to trying to, you know, come up with a million magical shots. I think, you know, the best storytelling is the simplest kind of storytelling.
Yes, yes.
And if you are able to tell a story or a scene in a master shot, you have done your job. And I feel like a lot of people are constantly getting coverage, and then you're like, end up with a million micro edits, and there's no one cares about the characters, and there's no gravity or weight to any of the scenes. So I think going back in time a little bit and thinking about, I mean, that's what I'm doing for myself. I'm writing a script right now where I'm like, can I write this script and do a lot of it in master shots, mainly because I want to have fun with the actors and really let them shine. And I think a lot of that comes through, the acting comes through when you let the scenes breathe. So there's a whole bunch of different theories, especially thinking about film theory and applying it to video theory or how, whatever you want to use the new world that we live in digitally. You can throw something on YouTube and you can do experimentation. And that's the other cool thing that we live in now is like look at Tangerine. That's like a film that was shot on an iPhone. It did cost money to make and you have actors and stuff.
Well, I mean, Tangerine was shot. It premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, and it was shot with an iPhone 5S. And I remember hearing that when they screened it at the Sundance Film Festival, and the filmmaker said, yes, we shot this on an iPhone 5S, the audience gasped. And it was produced, actually, through the Duplass Brothers production company, Mark and Jay Duplass, who... and it was shot, like, God, it shot around Santa Monica Boulevard, where all those...
Right, my office is shot right around the... Now it's Danny Trejo's donut hole, but it was shot...
Oh, is it really Danny Trejo's donut hole? Because I remember the donut hole, like, and there'd be, like, look, there are, you know, there are transvestite prostitutes, like...
Danny Trejo's pink donut hole. That would have been a better title for the restaurant, but I'm glad it's back.
But it's surprising, like, what can be done. And I do think that, like, just picking up your... I mean, we're actually recording this podcast on my phone. I mean, yes, we're going to tweak the audio.
While
we're driving. Well, luckily, I'm not driving.
I'm not driving either. Cody's driving. He's the hands of fate, our fate.
Yeah, but
these trucks.
Yeah, I know.
Weaving.
It's a weird... Yeah, this is not a good sign. But, well, we're going to talk a lot more. I mean, first of all, I want to mention that you can see the Film Threat Podcast live at Phoenix Comic Con this Friday, 7:30 p.m. You can look it up. You can go to phoenixcomiccon.com and check that out. Or check my... Yeah, we'll record it at least. And you can also check my social channels at That Chris Gore, or check at Film Threat on Twitter, filmthreat.com, Film Threat on everything, right? And you'll get all the information about it. Where can people find you on social media, Cody?
I got a Twitter. Tweet? CGID789. CGID789.
That's my tweet. CGID789 on Twitter. And John, where can people find you on the internets?
Well, on the internets, you can find me on Collider Movie Talk Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday on YouTube. And on my YouTube show called Collider Heroes, we do that once a week. We just did an episode with Nicola Scott. Chris Gore is a regular on the show. Robert Meyer Burnett's a regular. Amy Downs. We have a rotating cast of really fun, super cool nerds who come on. We talk all about the world of superheroes, supervillains, comic books, movies, TV shows. And then you can also find me on Twitter and Instagram, just at John Schnepp. And you can check out, once again, try to take a look at my Verse novel that's on Kickstarter. It's called Isolated Mutations of the Assembly Line Baby. It's a tongue twister. It's a really crazy book. I'm going to probably put up chapter one next week. I haven't put up anything about the book. It's just you can pre-order it right now. I'm keeping that as a special surprise. But definitely check it out and support my pre-ordering my book so I can make this this crazy book come to life.
And I also want to mention that we got a letter. We got a letter into the Film Threat Podcast. Anthony Ray Bench is not here, and he's not coming to Phoenix Comic Con. Anthony will return in a future episode of the Film Threat Podcast. But we got a letter. In fact, we got a bunch of letters. We got one from John Waugh, Shane Hamilton. And these are people who sent in. If you send a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Film Threat International Headquarters, 5042 Wilshire Boulevard, that's Wilshire Boulevard, PMB 1500, Los Angeles, California, 90036. Send us a self-addressed stamped envelope. I will send you Film Threat stickers for free so you can stick them on your car or on your Trapper Keeper.
Free stickers! Free stickers!
Or put it on your laptop, whatever. So, but one of the guys who sent us, and I'll read some of these letters. One of the guys who sent us a self-addressed stamped envelope, Lucas Dietz. He says, "Chris and Anthony, just want to let you know I greatly enjoy the podcast, and I'm looking forward to Blockbuster Busters, which is going to be our spinoff podcast coming soon. So I appreciate that." Jesus! God!
Whoa, 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 the truck! Hitchhikers don't own the road, man. I own.
Guys, let's get out of here.
Yeah.
I can't find my phone.